You can solve the structural sources of intergroup conflict, but if you don't have any grassroots programs that are promoting dialogue, that are promoting a shared identity, that are promoting those positive interactions across group lines, then you're not in a cohesive society.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. The reducing conflict and improving performance in the economy, spells RECIPE, program, established in April 2024 as a CEPR research initiative, it's funded by the UK Foreign Commonwealth and Development Office, FCDO, aims to provide a better understanding of the links between conflict, economic growth, and public policy. One of its themes is on what happens post-conflict, peacemaking, peace-building, and reconstruction. Salma Musa of UCLA and Lisa Hultman of Uppsala University are the theme leaders, and they join me now. Welcome, Salma.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And Lisa as well.
Thank you very much. Hi.
Now, Lisa, this is the first time we have discussed RECIPE on Vox Dev. What is RECIPE for? What's its aim?
Just like you said in the introduction, it is about looking at the links between conflict, economic growth, and public policy. So understanding the complexity of how these themes are related and how policy impacts the relationship between economic growth and conflict and lead to various outcomes that we're interested in. So I guess the overall aim of the program is to promote research in these areas and provide grants, organize conferences, various activities to kind of serve as a platform for making progress on these very big themes that fall under the project.
There are many themes, and yours is peacemaking, peace building. What sort of topics does that include?
These topics are huge in and of themselves,
yeah.
Right? Peacemaking, we can think of that as the efforts of the international community in bringing countries in conflict towards peace. It's mediation, peacekeeping, sort of establishing security, getting parties together. So the efforts of bringing some kind of peace, negative peace, in the first step. Then we have peace building, which needs to involve communities and understand how do we bring people together? How do we create the prospects and opportunities for peace for the groups and actors to overcome the differences and traumas that they have experienced? The theme that we are looking at wants to study these different processes, but also bring them together. If we want to make progress on these questions, we need to understand how do these macro international interventions impact the grassroots opportunities for bringing people together, and how do they interrelate?
There are other research projects in this area. How will RECIPE's approach differ from what already exists?
We're using a framework that has proliferated in recent years, which I think works really well, which is bringing policymakers like FCDO with academics to define what the cutting edge is of a certain research agenda and then fund research under that framework. What we're doing differently is first focusing on conflict specifically. So a lot of other times you have these research organizations where you'll have one arm that focuses on public health, another arm that focuses on gender, another on violence and conflict and crime, for example. What we're trying to do differently is focus substantively only on conflict. And as Lisa mentioned, we're able to have these themes be super tightly related. So by defining the research agenda, we can, for example, encourage all the different researchers to use the same set of outcomes or to speak to different pieces of the same problem in a way that creates a much more cohesive end product. So it gives us that bandwidth to actually create a kind of a massive body of research, we hope, that's all speaking to different smaller pieces of the same broader problem in a way that other research organizations might not be able to do because they have much more specialized units.
These are huge themes. Let's talk about peacekeeping first of all. I believe it's now 75 years since the first UN peacekeeping operation, which is very often what we associate with peacekeeping. What have we learned about how this can be effective?
Quite a bit. And maybe you and others have read stories in the news about peacekeeping failures and sort of critique of the UN. But if we look at research, and especially systematic quantitative research that seriously tries to account for the counterfactual, really try to get at the effectiveness of these missions, the story is pretty positive.
Right.
So a lot of studies using different types of data, using different methods, and looking at different types of outcome for security, find that UN peacekeeping has been impressively effective in bringing about peace, enhancing security by reducing violence between armed actors, by protecting civilians in these conflict contexts in which they operate.
General Martin Luther Agwai has arguably one of the UN's toughest jobs, heading the new armed peacekeeping force in Darfur. He takes over from a failed African Union mission.
And even though we've seen over the past 30 years or so, the UN getting involved in conflicts that are very complex and difficult.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not so always keeping the peace in these countries because there's no peace to begin with, but it's more of a peacemaking effort in that sense. But generally, it is effective. But of course, we've also learned more some nuances. And some of the main lessons, first, there needs to be some kind of ambition and political initiative from the Security Council to act on this, but it must be coupled with resources. So the Security Council cannot only sit and decide, like, this is a case where we want to get involved, but it also needs to fund these missions so that they have the capacities and resources on the ground to deal with the very complex problems. But then we've also learned that they need to be designed to solve the specific problems at hand. So they need the mandate to support specific actions that are needed, and they need to be composed in a way that's suitable for the situation. So some missions are heavily military operations, where the military can play a crucial role in establishing security, in patrolling border areas, etc. Whereas other situations need more, so police units, for example, because they have other training, they do different tasks, and they may also perform these very crucial tasks in these peace operations.
As you say, the media does tend to focus on when this goes wrong. When it does go wrong, how much do we know about that? Is it really all about getting the mandate correct?
Well, there are no easy answers. We have seen a little bit of a change in the most recent years, I would say. So since maybe 2013 or so, the UN has gotten involved in increasingly complex situations. Mm-hmm. For example, in Mali and DRC, where also the host governments start to question the presence. It could be that in these recent years, we would maybe see a decline in effectiveness overall. But coming back to the negative impacts, there are some studies that highlight the limitations of peacekeeping, saying, well, peacekeeping can be effective in reaching these 1, 2, 3 goals, but at the same time, it's unable to resolve these other problems. So We could have these two outcomes at the same time, right? And it's a military instrument to begin with. It can establish security, but it cannot resolve the political conflicts. It needs to be coupled with other processes like peace building efforts and a political support for a peace process. So it can achieve many of the outcomes that it's designed to achieve, but we often have very high expectations of what these missions are to achieve on the ground. But then at the same time, there are also these unintended consequences. So first of all, when you deploy 10,000 foreign troops in a country, it comes with this, you know, big footprint, and research has identified what we call like peacekeeping economies that are these bubbles that are established where peacekeepers are deployed. It comes with sexual abuse. And those are the most heartbreaking stories that come from several peacekeeping operations where these not only military, but international staff or people working for the UN in these missions take advantage of the situation of civilians, both through exploitation and abuse of various kinds.
Pauline is one of many women who were impregnated and later left behind by United Nations personnel in Haiti. Her twins were fathered by a UN police officer during the 13-year stabilization mission known as MINUSTAH.
And this has been acknowledged more and more by the UN. So we're seeing some progress on that in terms of how the organization itself deals with this. How do we identify these problems and how do we deal with them to make sure that they don't happen again?
How do we deal with them?
I don't know exactly how well they actually deal with them, but it's a matter of first identifying, getting information. So if a civilian person in these countries have been exposed to sexual abuse, the threshold for informing or bringing this issue to the UN can be huge. You know, do you go to the sort of army base and knock the door of the very same people who abused you? So it's been a lot about like getting these channels, opening ways for people to report what happens. But then it's also about like, how do commanders respond to this? And how do they create an environment where these things can be reported? And how do the contributor countries deal with this? Because ultimately, it's the countries that send peacekeepers that have the ability to punish the abusers.
Another theme in Recipe is to explore how humanitarian aid can, again, an unintended consequence, create violent competition for resources. Can you give me an example of where this is happening?
In contexts where there's weak state presence, mm-hmm. in fragile states where humanitarian aid is the most important for the civilian population, if there are also armed groups that compete for resources in these situations, whoever grabs these resources, gets the power of distributing them. And so it can generate these violence and this violent competition for controlling resources. And therefore, research has shown that it may increase violence against civilians, for example.
Is this about the amount of aid? There's not enough. Or is it about the way that the aid is delivered? As you say, the institutions are weak.
I would say it's the type of aid, so whether how lootable it is, and then also how it's protected and the strategies that are used for distributing them. It's difficult, right? Because it's really important in many of these situations. So only highlighting the problems of aid can be problematic. So the solution is not to stop giving humanitarian aid. But what Recipe could do, for example, is explore, like, how can we enhance safety in these situations? If peacekeepers protect the delivery of aid, for example, there are some studies that try to understand that interaction. Or are there other ways? Should it go through the government or should it be completely decoupled from the host government? And there are various ways in which we can explore the design of how humanitarian aid is distributed to better understand how we can provide the necessary resources to civilians in need while at the same time avoiding these negative externalities of resource competition.
One fascinating piece of your work, Lisa, has been that you've helped to create a data set of peacekeeping operations. I'm always fascinated by how you managed to get any data at all in these contexts. What are you trying to capture in this data? How difficult is it to assemble reliable data?
What we've done is try to get information about where peacekeepers are deployed mm-hmm. in this, what we call the geocoded peacekeeping operations data set. Mm-hmm. So the basic idea was there's been data around on where peacekeepers are sent to what countries.
Yeah.
But say we have a country like the DRC, which has had peacekeeping presence for a long time. It's a huge country.
Huge.
Where the UN decides to set up its bases is going to matter a lot for how they can deal with what patrols they could do, how they can interact with armed actors. So we wanted to build a data set, so getting information on exactly where they are based and who is where, because it also matters what contingents are sent to what location, how many they are. And the UN, of course, has this information, but it's sometimes a little bit difficult to get systematic information in a format that's suitable for researchers. So they have these maps. So each mission produces these maps that are often sent to the Secretary General in these reports. But the input data has not been accessible to us as researchers. So what we've done is basically to look at all these maps one at a time, figure out like what are all these symbols? What do they mean in terms of what kind of contingents are deployed? Getting the exact coordinates for each dot on that map, where they are based, and then put that in a spreadsheet. Using that, we can play around with spatial models of where peacekeepers are present and then couple that with data on violence and other types of data that we're interested in to get a sense of, do they go where they're most needed? Like, what is the local effect of these? And do they improve economic growth in those areas? Do they improve security for civilians, et cetera? That's what we've been doing. And it's a still ongoing process of coding these maps whenever they come out.
Another aspect of your theme is to look at coexistence, cooperation between groups after conflict. Salma, this is more in your area, isn't it? After conflict, how difficult is it to rebuild trust?
Very difficult, because conflict becomes part of a vicious cycle of underdevelopment, I would say. So you fall into this social trust trap where you have violence that makes group segregation more likely. So residential and social segregation more likely because there's distrust. You're less likely to have positive interactions. So that means disagreements are more likely to spiral into conflict. The more that your area is affected by conflict, the less likely you are to have a booming economy. You're not trading across group lines. You have security problems to a booming economy. And so this just becomes a vicious cycle of more and more distrust, more and more segregation, fewer and fewer opportunities for positive contact to actually rebuild that lost trust. And then you see the economic and political ramifications of that, that make the distrust more likely and violence more likely. So the more that the groups are not talking to each other, violence becomes more likely, and then you're back into this trap. The other reason why it's really challenging to rebuild trust is because it's very hard to deal with the structural roots of the conflict that started out in the first place. So even if you can mend some of the broken fences between people across group lines on a person-to-person level, if you haven't dealt with the structural root of the grievances, right? If there is systematic oppression, systematic power imbalances that are not being dealt with, then bringing people all together around a table talking about how much they like each other is not actually going to do anything. And then add to that, that group identities become much more entrenched. It's harder to build a cohesive national identity because people go into kind of a fight or flight mode. So I don't have any rational reason to trust strangers from the other group. I'm going to stick with my group. Sometimes it becomes also a rational response because you need to get resources in difficult circumstances. And so relying on people from your group is the easiest way to do that. And so you also don't want to trust others. Becomes much more rational to distrust strangers when the security situation is not stable and when you need access to resources. And then finally, you also might have to be dealing with issues of integrating perpetrators. And so not knowing who from the other group actually committed violence. So again, you're not likely to trust them because you don't know what their history is. And it's very hard to know what people did during the period of violence. And it's very hard to reintegrate those perpetrators of violence.
Rebuilding those institutions, the national identity was one that you mentioned. How important is it to do that? Who has the legitimacy post-conflict to do that?
It's really important to rebuild those institutions because that's the background framework and the background hum that's going to be structuring all of the lower level interactions. So it's very different for me as a member of an oppressed group, for example, trying to reconcile with a group that has systematically oppressed my group. It's much more difficult for me to have that conversation if my group doesn't have any structural protections, if I don't have any legal rights under the Constitution, if my group is not represented, right, in the government. So the structural part and the institutional part is super important. Who has the legitimacy to do it? So usually it's a mix of international bodies and local actors that have broad-based support and are seen as having like legitimacy also internationally. So where does the legitimacy actually come from? I'd say it's a mix of factors. It comes from being representative of the population. Important minority groups and particularly vulnerable groups need to feel like they're being represented. It comes from the ability to actually execute transitional justice and accountability. So that's where you get legitimacy from. You also get legitimacy from being seen as ensuring some kind of stability so that there's going to be some kind of economic development and a lack of kind of security failures and violence that's happening under your supervision and to do so transparently. So the transparency is also important and adhering to international agreements and post-conflict agreements also gives you legitimacy. So to give three examples, one is Rwanda. So you see the Rwandan Patriotic Front, the RPF, that actually led these peace-building efforts with the support of the international community, and they focused a lot on national reconciliation.
This scene was unthinkable 25 years ago. On the left, Cyprian, a Hutu who took part in the genocide. On the right, Louise, a Tutsi whose family was massacred. Today, they work and live together in what people here call Reconciliation Village.
Another is South Africa. So you had Nelson Mandela, who had broad-based support and legitimacy, and the ANC, who spearheaded this post-apartheid reconciliation program, who also focused on inclusivity and justice.
To listen to the victims of human rights abuses, to provide reparation, and to grant amnesty. These were the three main tasks of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission.
And also Bosnia and Herzegovina, where the Dayton Peace Agreement also established these power-sharing agreements between ethnic groups that also had oversight from international bodies.
So let's hope that the genocide will not be rewarded as it is right now, and that we cannot accept the Dayton Agreement coming from genocide to Dayton and from Dayton to genocide back again. That is unacceptable.
I'm actually really curious from Lisa, do you think those are good examples, Rwanda, South Africa, and Bosnia and Herzegovina, of kind of transitional governments that had broad-based legitimacy?
Yes, those are probably good starting points. And I think that this whole discussion kind of highlights also one of the tensions in the peacekeeping literature. So one of the problems that has been identified as one of these negative consequences we talked about is when the UN comes in and through design and by being in the UN, needing to cooperate with the host government, for example, mm-hmm. is perceived as supporting one of the sides in the conflict, perceived yes. as supporting the state. So it needs to rebuild these institutions, right? But when we have these grievances and oppressed groups, it may be perceived as siding with the oppressor at the expense of these other actors, at the same time as the mandate is to be impartial. So this question about who has legitimacy to rebuild institutions and decide how those institutions are designed is really a critical question. And one kind of that highlights how the macro level and the micro level that we talked about are interlinked and where we need to sort of bring these together to really understand the tensions and potential trade-offs.
We have covered projects for reconciliation after conflicts that literally go village by village. Are they a substitute for creating these institutions, which can be difficult and can take a long time, or are they always a complement to it?
Not just a complement, but you need the structural stuff and the grassroots stuff to be happening at the same time.
Right.
Like one without the other is not going to get you to the social cohesion that we want. You can solve the structural sources of intergroup conflict, but if you don't have any grassroots programs that are promoting dialogue, that are promoting a shared identity, that are promoting those positive interactions across group lines, then you're not in a cohesive society. It just means that you have stopped the violence and the structural inequalities, but you haven't moved forward to actually creating social cohesion. Mm-hmm. And on the flip side, if you have these grassroots programs and people actually are getting along on a person-to-person level, but you don't have the structural protections for vulnerable communities, then it makes those programs is really hard to scale up because, again, the rational response is, why would I engage in these programs if my group is not protected structurally? It's not rational to put people in these environments where the security situation is still in flux and their group has no recourse legally or constitutionally speaking. They're not represented politically. Why would I now go out and be like, I'm gonna just hang out and trust these strangers from this other group that has oppressed my people historically? So mm-hmm. you need them both. And actually, one example that I think about a lot is Northern Ireland, where I think that's an example where you actually have the structural protections in place. So the institutional level has kind of been dealt with. So you don't have the ongoing violence. There's been a peace accord that's like broadly been successful, but you see this really, really stark social segregation still. So places like that are places where I think the grassroots peace building programs are really promising because you have actually dealt with the structural, not perfectly, but you have actually addressed to a reasonable extent the structural sources of the intergroup grievances and conflict.
Oppressors and the oppressed post-conflict, those people will be living side by side. How much do we know about the policies to reintegrate people who find themselves in this situation? Some might be survivors of violence, and they find themselves face to face with the perpetrators of that violence.
That's obviously a very difficult thing.
Yeah.
One, because again, if you're from the oppressed group, in any given interaction with the group that has oppressed you, with a member of that group, you don't know their personal history of violence, right? So again, the rational thing is don't trust them. Why would you go out on a limb, okay, when there's no actual way? And this is a problem that we see, for example, in Iraq today. It's very hard to know who participated in ISIS. And so now, as a result, you have these camps, which are more and more being closed down, but you have tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands of families of suspected ISIS supporters or suspected ISIS affiliates. There's some system of security clearances, but we don't really know, right, who did what and who was responsible for what. And so it becomes really hard to reintegrate them afterward. Having said that, there are transitional justice programs and reconciliation commissions that don't rely on the kind of individual level accountability because it's so hard to establish. So you should prosecute people who you are able to prosecute. That's the number one thing you should do. But also just on a kind of broader social level, these transitional justice programs where you bring people together for dialogue and you bring perpetrators and victims in the same room. So you have these truth and justice and reconciliation commissions that kind of go village to village and have people sit around in a giant circle and actually come face to face with people who have perpetrated that violence. One of the best studies that we have of this work, which was conducted, I think, in Sierra Leone, found that victims who participated in these sessions did actually increase their social capital. Huh. It increased their feelings of social cohesion, but it did come at a cost to their mental health. So they're basically re-traumatized by being parts of these sessions. So it's not so simple. There are some trade-offs involved there, but that's probably our most prominent tool right now for bringing victims and perpetrators together.
Let's look at the future and what you could hope to achieve in your work with Recipe. One of the interesting things to me in the creativity of this work is how much more data is becoming available and the variety of sources from which that data is becoming available. What are we learning that's new from this? How can researchers employ this data?
There are a lot of new types of data that are being more and more used in social sciences, like satellite images are used to map conflict incidents and other types of development processes, large language models to process large chunks of data to extract information on a scale that was not possible a few years back. So This opens up a lot of new opportunities. And I think this is where a program like this is fruitful, because Recipe will start soon this year, be handing out grants for scholars to address this. And as always, when there are new types of data, new methods coming, it's the junior scholars that have a lot of competences and, you know, ambition to and ideas of how to exploit these. And so I think this is a great opportunity to get new creative ideas and bring in people together from economics and political science, different fields, people interested in the same type of topics, but with new ideas of how to exploit these data and ask new questions.
With these new questions, these new ideas, are there areas that either of you find particularly interesting, challenging? Salma?
One area that I really, really hope that our project kickstarts is linking the grassroots level peace building efforts to the structural level peacekeeping and violence as the outcome. For too long, we've had great work being done on intergroup contact and dialogue and prejudice reduction and perspective taking and empathy. And now the policymakers are coming back to us saying, but did that reduce conflict? Did that reduce violence? And it's really hard to do. It's really hard to take a study of 1,000 people and say this reduced violence, because violence is a community level outcome. Let's say you find all 1,000 people didn't engage in hate crimes or something, right? But that doesn't mean it actually changed anything in the equilibrium of the conflict. I really hope that we can do a better job of actually linking those two levels and running studies at a sufficient scale where we can, we ran this study in 500 or 800 or 1,000 villages, and we can look at the administrative data on violence and show that these grassroots interventions reduce violence, so that we can go back to policymakers and say this work is worth doing. Or maybe we find that it's not worth doing, and then we need to know that too.
Lisa?
It's not a job for any single scholar, right? This is where we need the collection of great minds out there to think about creative ideas of how to address it. So from my perspective, we know that there are these limitations of what international actors can do, but how do we link that with what we know from grassroots that does work, and how can international actors support that without undermining the very local processes that they're trying to support?
If we manage to do this well, if research is effective and it channels into policy, what is the potential here? What can we achieve?
To design good policy, we need to understand what works and what doesn't. I think a lot of policy making in these areas is not informed by what actually works, how these instruments work, but it's influenced by so many other factors. One example, sanctions. There are a lot of different ways that sanction can affect a situation. And I don't think policymakers think through, like, what are we trying to do? Are we just trying to signal this norm violation and signal how important it is to, so is it a communication tool to Russia that this is not acceptable? Or are we trying to change the behavior of the Russian government? Those are two very different things. And the sanctions need to be designed differently, potentially, for achieving those different goals. But I don't think policymakers have that knowledge and insight. So taking a step back by looking at these public policies and the impact of those on conflict, and then communicating those in a good way, I think through this recipe program, will hopefully have the impact of designing better policy in the future that's informed by what actually works. And I think that would be a huge step.
The potential for this is to actually reduce violence and improve economic development. I mean, it seems maybe a little pretentious or arrogant for like a group of nerds in these universities like to say, hey, we're going to fix the world. But that is what we're trying to do, is an effort, as Lisa said, to have some data-driven, evidence-driven policymaking. And the goal of these policies is to improve economic development and reduce conflict. And those are things we're trying to actively measure, actively test using randomized evaluation to make sure that we're doing this properly. And if it works, we'll also know what doesn't work. You know, I actually was at an FCDO conference last year, and one of the policymakers there was saying, people are always saying, fund this program and fund that program. But in order for us to do that, we actually need to defund other things usually. So you need to tell us what doesn't work so that we can shift resources away from those programs toward other things. And so if this works, I hope we actually affect those big outcomes that we're hoping to affect, but also that we can get a better picture of what doesn't work so that we can maybe tell policymakers how to reallocate those resources.
Salma, I wish you luck with it. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having us.
And Lisa as well.
Thank you.
If you want to find out more about Recipe, then normally at this time I tell people to Google it. Don't Google Recipe, you get completely the wrong information. Go to recipe.ceper.org. It's all there. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is to subscribe on your podcast platform on our past episodes. As always, well, they're on voxdev.org. If you like what you hear, please leave us a review and tell someone else.